Right, so I've volunteered to chair it myself, so I'm going to have to do that. Fine. Already there are two hands up, which is remarkable. Normally there are no hands up to stop three, in fact. Good. All right. All the better. And the first hand up is Joel's. Hi, Joel.
Hi, thanks for the talk. Very informative, well put together. At the outset, you did mention that war hasn't occurred in certain parts of the world for, forget how many
Eighty
decades.
years, at 18,
Yeah. Where we're having wars at the moment, certain parts of Africa, and obviously the Middle East, and obviously Russia and Ukraine. Again, it's, as we know, it's not just one reason. I mean, is a part of the war its ways a part, not the main cause? Is it to do with, say, emerging, what they call emerging nations?
Right, okay. Oh dear. I mean, yes and no. I mean, it's more to do with the major powers seeking to gain power over the emerging nations. Well, emerging nations, I mean, I'm talking about Russia, China, the US largely.
Yeah. When I
So
say emerging nations, I'm just, I suppose it's an inverted commas. It's just term that the media use, isn't it?
yeah. I mean, Iran, for example, one would call an emerging nation in the Middle East. But I mean, Iran is closely allied with Russia and to a certain extent with China, and that's why that's one reason why it think it feels capable of assisting the various sides in the Middle East who are waging war at the moment. And obviously, it chooses which side it's going to support. I mean, it's not impossible that certain nations will sort of become much more powerful and influential than they currently are.
Yeah.
I mean, China, for example, as apart from its size, in terms of its influence and wealth and ability to influence events, has sort of expanded massively since. Since Maoism, sort of, since the death of Mao Zedong, and that will probably continue. Okay.
Because
Not a very good answer, but
no,
any better.
I know it's a tricky one because, I mean, because some of the conflict between in certain countries, I mean, like ethnic groups, and I mean they don't seem to mention that the what they're really fighting for is, say, mineral resources or land or strategic areas, do they? They tend to talk about, well, we're oppressed because of our ethnicity, or and we're trying to sort of like get a better standing in that particular country, but they don't really talk about the mineral resources or
No, it's
land
not said. I
or
agree with you. It's not said explicitly at all. No, it's not said explicitly. That they talk about the rule of law and fairness and all sorts of different things, but they rarely talk about the need for capitalist expansion and control of resources, trade routes, etc. Yeah, I mean, but when looked at, sort of, when you see what's going on underneath, I think that's the kind of thing that emerges. I know that Andy's written Andy Davis you, in the notes in the messages in the chat. Sorry, that's the word. He's written war in Western Europe was probably averted due to homogenization of states after World War II. European Trades Council, EEC, EU, etc. Absolutely. Also NATO. And that's what's happened, in fact, that war has been averted because you've had these sort of blocks of states, etc., these states that have come together, but which only shows that it's not inevitable. You know, that even within capitalism, there are ways of averting it. And this is one way that's been found.
Well, I mean, obviously the capitalist class would... They would prefer not to have war because it costs a lot of money, doesn't it, to fight it?
Yeah.
And I mean, if they could sort of achieve something without having to sort of wage war, I mean, I would have thought they'd prefer that angle.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah, and they definitely do, no doubt about it. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you, Joel. Okay. Next, Joy.
Oh, hi, thanks. A really good talk. Thanks, Howard. Just to refer back to the 80 years of peace, do you not think of Bosnia as Western Europe? I'm just thinking, because of my cultural background, I think of the former Yugoslavia as being almost Western Europe.
Yeah, I mean, saying that, I did think of Bosnia actually, and I suppose I would regard that as sort of as Central Europe, as the sort of the Eastern European sphere of influence. But if you want to call it Western Europe, you can. In which case, you know, I'd have to sort of, you know, change the terminology I'd use, not just Western Europe, but, you know, Western Europe within certain boundaries. But I understand what you're saying. Yeah, and
That we got so incensed 2 years ago about Ukraine. I mean, it's no nearer than Bosnia. I mean, it's slightly further away, in fact.
Ukraine's further away than Bosnia.
Slightly, yes.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
I think the former Yugoslavia has been next door to Italy.
Which it is, yeah.
Which it is. And also, how would you classify Northern Ireland? I mean, it's been euphemistically called the Troubles. I mean, to me, it was a war.
Yeah. I mean, I did think of that as well. That's why I said there's not been any war to any great extent. But it was a kind of war. It's true. Yeah. It was. Yeah. So that would modify that statement. Yes, certainly. Yeah. But I you know, it was on my mind when I said that. Yeah, I mean, you know, but by many standards, one would call it a war. I mean, again, you know, how exactly to define it? You know, why do some, as it were, authorities say there are 110 wars going on, and others are saying there are 28? It depends on your specific definition.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, thanks. Right, Jarvis, over to you. You're muted at the moment. You're muted.
Working on it. Can you hear me now?
You've got it, yeah.
I didn't want to come in too soon, yeah. Just to reiterate what people have said already, Howard, thank you, and good evening, comrades, and you, Howard, for an illustrious and edifying talk. Thoroughly enjoyed it. I was delighted to hear you mentioned the work of Harari. I remember reading that book not very long after it came out. I've been quite delighted with parts of it. Of course, his conclusions aren't as drastic as ours, but that's what happens. By way of contribution, I'd like, if I might, to paraphrase the late Christopher Hitchens, a man whose scholarship I thoroughly admire and whose politics I generally despise. However, he was good in some fields. And when he's talking about the history of human development, he talks about a period similar to Harari, about 70,000 years ago, where estimates suggest that humanity was down to maybe 50,000 Homo sapiens in the west of Africa. And, you know, a little tip either way, and we would have been extinct. But he makes the point, and he makes it quite clearly. If it were the case that we didn't know, as a species, that rape and murder and theft and oppression were just not in our interests, we would never have gone on to colonize the entire planet and dominate it almost completely. You know, that simply would not have happened if we weren't able to cooperate and act as a community. I think that's a very important point. Lovely to hear the recommendation of Bloody Foreigners by Richard Winder. I did read the article in The Guardian a month or so ago. I will be seeking out a copy of the book. One more point on the subject of no war in Europe for 80 years. Come on. I think we're pretending here. There is war going on all over the world, and it is funded and supplied by Western Europe. And it's done with a specific objective in mind of forwarding or furthering the interests of the Western capitalist class. The war in Ukraine would have been over by now were it not for the billions upon billions of dollars worth of weapons that have been supplied from the West. You know, there has been no peace since the end of World War II. There won't be any peace as long as we have capitalism. But I think to argue that Europe is not involved in war at the moment is fundamentally mistaken. Anyway, thanks once again for a fabulous talk.
Thanks, Jarvis. Yeah, I suppose what I meant wasn't that Europe wasn't involved in war in the sense that it's supporting other powers that are waging war. What I had in my mind was that before the Second World War, the European countries were fighting amongst themselves. There was war taking place everywhere in Western Europe. And Western Europe wasn't fighting against other countries, it was fighting amongst itself. That's gone now. And it's gone for the reasons that I think Andy mentioned, that states have sort of come together, as it were. They've come together. And it seems highly, highly unlikely now that wars will break out between France and Germany, or Germany and Spain, or Spain and Italy, et cetera, et cetera. Yes, they may well back other wars in other places. They're very, very likely to indeed, yeah, and they are doing at the moment. You know, the war in Ukraine is being backed by Western European powers. Yeah, it is. But I noticed that Andy's also mentioned the Spanish Civil War. Well, that was pre-Second World War, wasn't it? I'm talking about since the Second World War, since sort of 1945-6. That's sort of in the 80 years that have passed since then. There haven't been any sort of, you'd have to exclude Northern Ireland, okay, but apart from that, there haven't been any wars in Western Europe. Right, who's next? Anyone? Paddy, over to you.
Just to follow up on that point, really. I thought it was, when you said, there haven't been any wars in Europe since the Second World War, my first response was, well, that's because we're just bloody lucky. That was just dumb luck. And also Andy's point about the modernisation of Europe. But, there are signs that that's all starting to come undone. And, I think Jarvis is right. You know, globally, the big picture is, war's been pretty much constant here and there since the Second World War. I don't want to put a downer on what you were saying, Howard, because I thought it was really good, and definitely agree with what you were saying. I think that we want to be a little bit cautious about, the post-war history of Europe, as in terms of being some kind of broader indicator. I think it was really much more sort of contingent than that, and I think it was quite interesting that, when you mentioned Steven Pinker, and, he came out with this argument, well, he mostly stole this argument, that, violence, organised violence and human-on-human violence has reduced around the world in the last few hundred years. It's kind of the same objection that actually if you sort of dig into that, what it turns out is it only reduced in certain places, and particularly in Europe. It was very patchy, and in other places it went up, and even in Europe it went down, then it went up, then it went down again, this sort of thing. All of this is tied up with social conditions. So you've got quite a prosperous sort of society, and it isn't in direct conflict, either trade conflict or some other conflict with its immediate neighbours, you're going to get a fairly peaceful period in capitalism. but there's, you know, you can't really sort of conclude that much about that. And Pinker's big, I think, error, I think most a lot of people would say, is that he attributes the reduction in violence in Europe to state control, whereas what you were seeming to do was to attribute the reduction in violence to some kind of, I know you didn't say this, but some kind of, you know, inner, I'm trying to find a way to not say human nature, but predisposition towards peace or cooperative behavior. Now, I don't even particularly think there's anything wrong with that argument, because if you look at the vast sweep of human, the time that humans have been on the earth, around about 300,000 years, actual warlike behavior is pretty anomalous. It's quite recent. It's really not much older than the Neolithic. So it is pretty anomalous, and the fact that it's going down could well be a sign of this, you know, humans' kind of like natural desire to just get on with things and not cause any trouble and not get in any fights. On the other hand, the right wing, led by gurus like Steven Pinker, will respond, no, it's not because of that, it's because we really are animals underneath it all, and the only reason that violence is being reduced is because of strong capitalist state control. So I just bear in mind, any sort of example that you come up with, the right wing is going to have an answer for it. Anyway, that was what I was going to say.
Yeah, thanks, Paddy. Yeah, I wasn't supporting Steven Pinker, by the way. He's written this book called The Better Angels of Our Nature, which, you know, says the kind of thing you just said. I know. And I wasn't supporting his position, but his position is that it's very, very difficult for people not to be violent because, you know, they tend to be. But, you know, as you say, if you've got a strong state, they can prevent that. No, I wasn't supporting that at all. I think it's much more like that human beings basically want a quiet life, want peace, and it's only if they're put under enormous pressure that they can be, they can be persuaded to fight wars, as it were, to use the collective violence, which is what characterises wars. Andy, you've got your hand up. Over to you. You're muted at the moment, Andy.
Yes. Sorry about that. I was looking for the unmute button. Sorry. Thanks, Howard. That was very informative. And from my old student days, actually, names of authors and scholars that were mentioned sort of remind me of days gone by, really. I thought, oh, gosh, yes, I think I know that name, you know, from this book and that sort of perspective of looking at this whole subject. I made a few other notes whilst I was looking at this. One of the things that I hope I don't go off a tangent on it. I don't want to speak for too long either, because Howard, I'm sure, can respond really well on this. I was quite struck. I don't know if you did it deliberately or whether it was just a sort of a natural flow of the talk. But it was really good the way that you, and I don't mean this in a bad way, but you sort of, I can't think of another word of it at this time on a Friday night, but it was like conflating religion and nationalism and the kind of way that nationalism's become a sort of religion and a secular religion. And there was somebody that you made reference to that made that, tried to drive that kind of direction of argument. But also what must be really difficult now, increasingly difficult in the future for any government, and particularly for democratic governments, Western European secular liberal democracies, is to provide that nationalism as some form of secular religion, or in a more kind of day-to-day way, to find sort of shared national experiences that everybody can join in with such as, you know, the royal family and special occasions for that, or the England football team and this sort of thing, in the context of this more, much more globalised economy, and the globalised economy of labour as well. Now, where I live, I'm lucky I live in quite a nice little patch, but very close by, there are communities where it's really quite hard to get by. A lot of those people in those communities, in particular where I work, for example, in the part of Wolverhampton where I'm based in my day job, it's really poor. And there are people from all sorts of different backgrounds living in those back-to-back houses in those streets. And that's all around the Wolverhampton area. There are big high-rise flats, loads and loads of people. But, you know, as I drive through, and I'm going to be just say this as it is, right? Hopefully I won't be hauled over the coals for this, but they don't look like you and I. In other words, they're mostly not white people. Or if they are, they don't speak English as a first language. Now, I'm not saying that those people are not welcome in any way at all by myself or by my friends and family. But what I'm trying to drill into here is just how is it possible, and I'm thinking future here, for any sort of authority over this, a nation state, to then cohere around these sort of shared national experiences for such a sort of culturally diverse group of people. People I work with, I've got staff who hail from India, from parts of Africa, etc. I've got a fantastic staff team that I manage in the care home that I manage. It's wonderful. We all get on brilliantly. But they each then live in their own cultural bubbles, and I live in mine, obviously, as well. So I just thought that would – it just raised a point, really, with me. But what I also take from that and bring home every evening is how peaceful – how cooperative and how respectful we are with each other. You know, we get on brilliantly, and I'm really lucky that I know those people, and that hopefully they think that I'm a nice enough fellow as well, and I'm a decent person in terms of my relationship with them at work. So it sort of, it just makes me wonder about whether, you know, the, as you spoke about quite early on, I think, in the talk, Howard, the impetus of capitalism to speed up, you know, technology speeding up, cultural development is speeding up, other things are speeding up, whether this is forming what I think Marx at one point talked about as a universalizing tendency of capitalism. To, you know, some people back in my younger days called it the McDonaldization of society, but that's not all necessarily all negative either. So anyway, I've probably spoken and rambled a bit more than I intended to there, but just wondered whether that stirs anything up for you.
Yeah, thanks very much, Andy. I think Robert Winder, this Bloody Foreigners book, is very instructive on the way in which this country and all other countries have absorbed people from all sorts of other cultures over long periods of time. And at a certain point, you look round and think, oh, we're all very much the same. But in fact, it wasn't always the way. I mean, I've just opened Robert Winder's book on the introductory page. I'll just read the first couple of sentences, which I think sort of, you know, very pertinent to what you've just said, Andy. He says, imagine for a moment we could watch from some all-seeing camera high in space the long history of the British Isles unfolding before our eyes. Among the brief flashes of light and shade, summer and winter, the most striking sight would be the astounding traffic into and out of our ports. Thousands of ships and planes, millions of people year after year, century after century, our country would seem defined by countless comings and goings. We would not see that some of the arrivals never leave, or that some of the departures never return. We might not detect the endless mixing and stirring of the population. But as the centuries flew past, we would witness the slow advance and steady transformation of a country and a people. It would seem an epic story. It's a very good book, this, extremely well written as well. And, you know, it sums up the history of migration there in just a sort of short paragraph. Obviously, it goes into a massive amount more detail in the in the pages of the book as a whole. But yeah, but anyway, yeah, interesting point there, Andy. Yeah, nobody's got their hand up at the moment, and since they haven't, I'll maybe take advantage of that to read a little story from the Harari book about the way in which people are primed, or countries, if you like, are primed to try and seize territory, to seize economic advantage anyway, if they can. And it'll take about 2 minutes, that's all. It's in a chapter entitled The Marriage of Science and Empire. That sums it quite well. On the 20th of July, 1969, Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin landed on the surface of the moon. In the months leading up to their expedition, the Apollo 11 astronauts trained in a remote moon-like desert in the western United States. The area is home to several Native American communities, and there is a story or legend describing an encounter between the astronauts and one of the locals. One day as they were training, the astronauts came across an old Native American. The man asked them what they were doing there. They replied that they were part of a research expedition that would shortly travel to explore the moon. When the old man heard that, he fell silent for a few moments and then asked the astronauts if they could do him a favor. "What do you want?" they asked. "Well," said the old man, "the people of my tribe believe that holy spirits live on the moon. I was wondering if you could pass on an important message to them from my people." "What's the message?" asked the astronauts. The man uttered something in his tribal language and then asked the astronauts to repeat it again and again until they had memorized it correctly. "What does it mean?" asked the astronauts. "Oh, I cannot tell you. It's a secret that only our tribe and the moon spirits are allowed to know." When they returned to their base, the astronauts searched and searched until they found someone who could speak the tribal language, and they asked him to translate the secret message. When they repeated what they had memorized, the translator started to laugh uproariously. When he calmed down, the astronauts asked him what it meant. The man explained that the sentence they had memorized so carefully said, "Don't believe a single word these people are telling you. They have come to steal your lands." I think that's extremely funny anyway. It sort of sums so many things up too. Okay. Any other questions or contributions? By the way, Andy, the secular this reference to secular religion actually came from Robin Cox, one of our own members, in an article he wrote in, is it last month's Standard, in a recent Standard anyway.
Yeah, I have to catch up with the Standards, actually, to be really honest. I just find it really difficult to keep up with things at the moment, personally speaking. Yeah. But the Standards, the actual presentation of the Standards have been looking brilliant, really good.
Yeah. Back to you, Paddy.
All it was because the subject was war, and you've done such a magisterial treatment of it, Howard. I wondered if you wanted to sort of make any comments about the current state of affairs. There's a lot in the news about Putin saber rattling with nukes, and the West sort of saber rattling back, and there are people who are sort of chewing their knuckles at the prospect of World War III. Personally, I don't see it, but I don't know. I just wondered if you had any thoughts on it.
Yeah, I mean, I know within the party there are a few, differences of opinion about this, about this and about the war in the Middle East, for example. I mean, I think we all agree what underlies these wars, or it underlays, no, underlies these wars. And we all agree that we're opposed to both sides, but our actual analysis of what's causing them within the system, may differ from one member and from one sort of view of sort of things from another. I mean, if people look at the on the website, if they look at the blog where people sort of put down their views on what's going on in these places, then you'll see that there are differences of opinion, and there's no reason why there shouldn't be. I know, for example, that I was criticised for putting together one of these snippets on the which appear on the homepage of the website, which was sort of highly critical of Putin on the grounds that, you know, we don't accuse him, it's not individuals, it's the system, etc. But I was sort of making a monster of Putin. I think he's a monster, anyway, it so happens. But apparently we shouldn't be doing that. Fair enough. Okay. Yeah. I can understand that. I suppose what I'm saying is that I'd rather, you know, in this context, I'd probably rather not sort of stick my neck out. I think it was an enormous surprise to most people, but I won't say to everyone, that Russia actually invaded Ukraine. An enormous surprise. I mean, most people didn't expect it. They expected saber-rattling, etc., and, you know, some kind of agreement on something would emerge from that. It was an enormous surprise. You know, I suppose maybe it shouldn't have been, because very shortly before, Putin said there's no question that would happen. And it's usually the case that when Putin says something, the opposite happens. Can't trust the word he says. But nevertheless, it was a surprise. It was. And again, you know, unforeseen consequences. He can't possibly have thought that, what is it, getting on for 3 years later, the conflict would still be going on. I'm not sure what he thought would happen. Clearly, you know, once these things sort of get started, there's no envisaging how they'll sort of progress and end. I mean, you know, if you look at the sort of statistics at the moment, it appears that, both sides have nearly 100,000 people have been killed on both sides, 100,000 soldiers. They don't know how many other people have been killed or injured. Phenomenal, really. Janet, I think it's you next.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Howard. That was really interesting and quite, it brings forward lots of contributions. I was thinking that we still discuss these wars as within the confines of national boundaries. We talk of the wars in Africa or Europe or in Asia. I think that we forget that capitalism is a global economy now. It isn't just confined to one country, one rich class in different countries. Those people that are members of the ruling class, the capitalist class, are probably themselves almost universal. They can go from one country to another. They have houses in all different parts of the world. They're immensely rich and able to move around the world without even thinking of a national boundary. It doesn't stop them from having to fit in with the nationalities when they want to advance their financial resources or gain further land or whatever, because they are still having to operate with the nationalities, and they had to call those people to account to act for them in the cases of different outbreaks of violence that might happen under the laws that govern war within capitalism. And I think that it still is a very, very stratified society throughout the world, because I've been in places where I think, as Andy has said, you get people in hospital, you get people from all different parts of the world, and on the surface they are getting on very well, cooperating, organising, quite friendly, and hopefully that is the ruling situation. But I've also seen quarrels break out between different people, different staff members who come from different parts of the world and have probably not the quarrels that they're going on about, but some underlying dislike of the other person because they come from a different part of the world. And I see that with people that we had to have carers coming into the house when my husband was ill. There's many of them, four times a day, coming from all different parts of the world, as Andy has pointed out, to help look after him. And they generally gone all very, very well. They seem to, and they looked after my husband very well as well. But they didn't always, there was an underlying antagonism between some of them as well. Again, coming from different parts of the world, there is a dislike for the other person, the other social group. And it isn't easily, change is constant, but it isn't as quickly enough in all parts of the world. So that we've got people now in all parts of the world living in Britain, but not necessarily happily together, bearing each other because they have to. Employment is a great lowering of and enabling of groups to get on together because they have to get on together. And sometimes I think that can help people become friendly and know more about the other and therefore find less reason to dislike them. But it takes a lot to change people's attitudes. And I think that still the capitalist class might dislike this and have to fit within it, but they still have to get these people to come together to cooperate in the time of war. So they'll go into the army and fight the other, who's only just a few miles away, really, across the border. The business of being different and the other is not worn down within the last 80 odd years, to my knowledge. There's still a big difference, a big divide between many people. And capitalism doesn't necessarily wipe that out, not within a few generations anyway. It takes a long time. People are indoctrinated in our education, in the social groups that we live in, and that takes a long time to wear down. I think that within Europe, in Britain and the other Germany, Spain, France, those sorts of countries have now developed laws of people saying you must use politically correct language. You mustn't say this about someone else because it's going to hurt their feelings. That's a sign of advanced civilization, but it doesn't necessarily operate in other countries that are yet developing because they're still, I guess the ruling class in parts of Africa doesn't really like all the gang warfare that's going on, but they can't hardly control it. And that is something that seems to take hundreds of years. And I don't think the world has got that time now with the problems of the climate change. I'm going to stop now. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Janet. I mean, these things can take a long time. It's true, but it depends on the context. Again, take professional football, for example. Maybe 30 years ago, there were hardly any sort of footballers with sort of darker skins or from foreign countries. There are loads of them now in the professional leagues. And what do the fans think of them? They absolutely love them. You know, they score a goal and the fans are all over them, hugging them and shouting their name and so on. So these things do very much depend on context. You know, they don't see them as different. They become completely colorblind and, you know, nation blind when the circumstances are favorable to that happening. But yeah, okay, interesting. Anyway, Janet, Andy, back to you.
Well, it was actually, I'd like to pay tribute to Janet in this respect for giving me a heads up. There's two or three things I'm trying to just quickly remember while I make my point. Howard, you can't say colorblind. You're not allowed to say that now. You must be inclusive, okay?
Sorry. Right? you can't say coloured. I'm not sure whether you...
No. You cannot say colourblind. I've been on the training. I've done the equality and diversity training.
Okay. Yeah, I'll take it away from you. Yeah, okay. I'll remember that. I will remember that. I will take that on board. Okay.
Thank you. Now it's not a dressing down.
Andy, can I say colourblind?
Yeah. I beg your pardon?
Can I say colourblind?
You say whatever you want.
That's what I say.
Yeah, I know. So whatever. Secondly, and again, paying tribute to Janet Carter, I was very guilty until relatively recently of like just passively reading mainstream media, and obviously, I would try to click my own brain into a critique of this. But, you know, sometimes it kind of overwhelms you. You know, we're so surrounded by this 24-hour news and it's mainly all like right-wing orientated, whichever way you look at it. Janet turned me over to a very good resource. I'm sure most of you know of it already. So if I'm telling you or asking you or suggesting you how to suck eggs, Howard, you're accepted here because you're a vegan. Any other vegans don't have to suck eggs. But it's called Media Lens. Anybody know Media Lens? Medialens.org.
Yeah, I know that.
You know that, Paddy, yeah. Now, I found that a really very good... accessible, easy to read resource that's really quite down to earth, but also puts alternative perspectives and a critical and, you know, a good analysis of the media output in mainly, I think, UK and Western and possibly America. I haven't read it to that large extent. But in terms of the issues around the way that wars are reported, and specifically for me, the way that the war with Russia and Ukraine has been reported, I really urge people to have a look at it. They've put something out which is basically called I think it's something like the something like, you know, you're not allowed to say that. And it's really just what I think has happened in respect of NATO pushing and pushing and pushing at Russia. Don't want to talk about that right now, but I would just say, please do read what Media Lens have got to say about it, because they use a lot of sources and evidence as well on that. And I think that was all I wanted to say on that. So thanks.
Okay, thanks for that, Andy. Right, we're past nine. Joy's got a hand up, so perhaps we'll take Joy's contribution, and then we'll wind up after that, if that's acceptable. So, Joy, over to you.
Okay, Howard, how recent is this phenomenon of the foreign football players being accepted and adored? Because I seem to remember that not that long ago, a lot of the fans, so-called fans, I call them idiots, were throwing bananas onto the pitch and making monkey noises. Now, my memory.
Sorry, your sound isn't brilliant, Joy. We've got the message.
I'm sorry, I keep cutting out. My device is on the blink.
Got the message, though, I mean, I remember when, many years ago, when there were about two black players in the Premier League going to see Manchester United with my son when he was little. There was one player who played for Norwich, forgotten his name, Rule Fox, he was called. That's right, I remember now. Some of you who are football fans may remember him. And all sorts of things were being shouted at him. And nobody turned a hair. Nobody turned a hair. Couldn't possibly do that now, apart from the fact that, you know, all teams have got sort of, you know, black and foreign players, etc. I would say it's the last sort of. That's right. And I remember watching Swansea. I sort of watched Swansea City intermittently, and when black players first started to play, Swansea had they had three or four. They had four black players, and they were referred to in the media as the flat black four. Now that's just couldn't do that now. Rather than the flat back four, the flat black four. I would say it's a phenomenon that's sort of developed over the last, 10, 15 years, something like that. But I'm happy to stand corrected on that. Right, several other people have got their hands up now. Jarvis, go on.
Yeah, I mean, just to, am I unmuted? I am this time. Yeah, just to echo what Andy's saying in the chat there. I spent a portion of my childhood in West Bromwich. And so, of course, we would be dragged occasionally to, when the family could afford it, West Bromwich Albion matches. And there were two recent signings, Cyril Regis and Laurie Cunningham. And I remember being horrified when even West Bromwich Albion fans were chanting, "Regis, Regis, give me that banana." I never was into the football. We just got dragged along. I got dragged along. My older brother was a lot more into it than me. But yeah, I mean, racism was a big part on the football terraces then. I think it still is now, actually. And when you hear, I don't even follow football, but this Mo Salah fella apparently is pretty good. And the fans are chanting something that refers to him as a Mo Salah, a gift from Allah, or some stuff like this. There's still racism on the terraces. It might seem to have been a little bit more toned down, but it really is still there. But then, you know, any kind of sport that has that kind of tribe mentality is going to engender that kind of idiocy. I go along with Joy on that. I just don't get football.
Okay. Thanks, Joel.
Yeah, it's just on the topic of the football topic. I mean, the amount of overseas players now, they've basically come in, haven't they, really, with the Premiership starting because, and they know, the clubs know that it's advantageous to have players from all parts of the world playing them because it further increases their chances of being successful and bringing more money into the club. I remember some of the things you're talking about, Howard, in terms of football, because, I mean, like West Bromwich Albion, they had, when Ron Atkinson was there, I mean, they had Regis Cunningham and what's he called? He became a union rep for footballers. Brendan Batson. I mean,
Brendan Batson.
Yeah, he called them. They'll call the 3 degrees. yes. I mean, it's. I understand what you're saying, Jarvis. I mean, there are some parts of Europe where, you can go to, and if you're not white, you can get some real offensive comments thrown your way. It's in the interest of leagues in various countries to sort of improve or try and eradicate the offensive chant, because they want to appeal to a wider audience. Want to bring, they want children coming in. They want women coming in. They want families coming in. I mean, in those days where it was absolutely rife, I mean, there's a lot of people wouldn't go because of it. But anyhow, thank you.
Thanks, sir. We've got off the subject a bit now, but Andy, last one to you then. Go on.
Yeah. I think I tend to agree. Well, everybody said really on this point about football. But I think what you've got to understand is that when players like Clyde Best came along at West Ham, he was a black player. And like, you know what? I always remember my dad and my dad's mates from the factory. They had absolute utmost respect for Clyde Best. You know, they just thought he was, like, remarkable. There was another player at Leeds as well, I remember, who was a black player.
Albert Johansson.
Albert Johansson, yeah.
South African.
That's right, yeah. That was, I remember I got, because I collected, like, Shoot magazine from, like, you know, the 60s and all that type of thing. Albert Johansson. So it wasn't necessarily all negative. But what you've got to understand as well, Howard, is, like, football is, you know, I mean, I used to go to football matches when I was a kid and, into my 20s. It's really very, very hostile environment, okay? So you'd be in one side of the Witten Arms as a Villa fan, right? The other side, you'd have West Ham. And it would be like, you know, like you thought you were going to get killed, you know, and it was like you're going home in an effing ambulance and all this type of thing. So it's become a really sanitized sort of environment now, football. It's become everybody has to sit down. You don't get people pissing on your neck from the stands up above and all that type of thing. It's a really sort of sanitized thing. And it's what Joel said. It's become a globalized industry. It's not just like, you know, the sort of little market town sort of cottage industry that it used to be. Anyway, no time's getting on. So, but I thought that would actually make a some form of discussion for the future actually could be interesting.
Yeah. Bit off this subject, off the subject of war, but, you know, okay.
Well, it's sort of war by another means.
Yeah. All right. Well, look. Thanks to everyone for attending and contributing. And I don't know. I mean, have we got a talk schedule for next week? Can anyone say? Adam, any idea?
Yeah. It's supposed to be. Have you heard the news? But Andy sort of preempted that. So by doing it last week, but whether we want to do that again next week, I mean, I can give a talk on Lenin if you want to. You know.
That sounds good, Adam. Yeah, why not give a talk on Lenin? Yeah.
Anyway, nothing's been arranged. The default one is it'll be, have you heard the news again? But we'll see.
Okay. I vote for Lenin. Yeah. I vote for Lenin.
Yeah. Oh, I can do that because I've got to do a talk on Lenin anyway for the Oxford Communist Corresponding Society. So I'll do a test run, if you like, on here. Yeah.
Okay, all right. Let's say Lenin for next week.
It's called What Was Done, Lenin's Miscalculations.
Rather than What Is To Be Done, right, okay.
What was done, yeah.
What was done, right, okay. Good one, yeah, all right. Okay, right, well, good night then. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Howard.
Thank you, good night.
Thanks very much. Cheerio.